Shalom, damn it! Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, the radio program, which is usually hosted by my friend Dave Lefkowitz, but I'm taking this segment now because I get to talk to a talented Jew. A Jew who has been on Broadway in a wonderful show years ago called Exceptions to Gravity that he still performs and is bringing back as we speak. Maybe you also saw him in the movies, in the most featured role in the movie Jewel of the Nile, or In the Nile, or maybe I'm in denial of the title, I have to check that. Anywho,
the Jew of the Nile.
He's the Jew of the Nile, that's it. And maybe, if you happen to attend Etz Chaim Synagogue, he is a board member there. So that may be the most important thing of all. His name is Avner Eisenberg, but he prefers to be called Avner the Eccentric, and I'm exceptionally excited to talk to Avner the Eccentric on the radio this morning. Shalom, Avner, how are you doing?
Shalom, good. I'm doing good. I got a cold, but I'm good.
You got a cold, but does that matter since you're on stage and you don't talk?
Well, occasionally I keep a box of Kleenex on stage and we'll take a little break. No, not really.
Now, wait a minute. Speaking of a box of Kleenex on stage, I did want to ask this, because if you go to his website or you go to YouTube, you can see various videos of Avner doing his mime thing. And I have to ask, there's this scene where you're eating napkins.
Exactly.
You're like a hobo or a street person, and you're sitting down to a lovely meal. Like, instead of Charlie Chaplin eating the boots, you're eating napkins.
Yeah.
Can you at least... Is that food, or is that actually paper that you're, what are those things made out of?
Let's put it this way. If it was rice paper or sugar, anybody could do it.
If it was rice paper, aha, I gotcha.
But the best part, my son, at the end of it, so I eat a lot of paper.
Right.
And it's a kind of, I see it as a kind of Jewish humor. It's the end of the show. It's a show that never starts. Of the show, that I'm the janitor of the theater, and I'm just giving a last little sweep before the show, and I pick up little pieces of paper, which you can see this all on YouTube. You can see bits and pieces of the show, and the paper explodes into a sign that says show starts in 5 minutes. So we wait, and while we're waiting, different things happen. I mess around with stuff. 20 minutes later, I look at the clock. 4 minutes left. Another 20 minutes goes by. Look at the clock again. 3 minutes left.
It's kind of like watching C-SPAN.
It's all the way to the end of the show.
Yes.
And curtain calls, and I thank the technicians, and we do the lights up, the lights down, and I go look at the clock, and with a great sigh of apology, I go, but there's 1 minute left. So I finally sit down to a well-deserved meal, and there's nothing but paper. So I make the best of it.
And you actually do funny things and eat the paper in a very funny way.
It's got a ton of magic tricks in it. I produce a glass of wine. I make a mask, and the mask eats itself.
Oy.
I do origami. I make an origami bird, and I eat the bird. And in the end, I pull out all the streamers of white paper, and on the end of the streamers pulls out a huge bouquet of flowers bigger than my head.
Oh, my God. Tell me something. You just told us the entire show. Why should people go see it now?
I told you the last 4 minutes.
Oh, that's very good.
And you won't believe it even when you see it.
Well, actually, it's definitely worth checking out YouTube to see clips of it. He's very agile, very funny, and speaking of which, you are, I think, what, 62 years old at this point?
64.
64. Does it get harder? Do you feel different than you did in your 20s and 30s and 40s when you started doing...
I'm getting out of bed in the morning.
Oh, is it really? It is more difficult?
That's the hardest part of my day. No, it's... there are things I had to take out. I stopped walking the slack rope about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. I stopped diving over children. I feel like... Who was it? I think it was Mark Twain. He said, yes, I've given up cigars and minced meat pie after midnight.
Okay. No, but there are things you had to sort of change or finesse a little bit as you get older.
They're physical things, but I think my understanding of the art of communication with the audience and making these jokes has gotten better. So in a lot of ways, I feel more comfortable.
goodness.
I'm just an adolescent.
Oh.
I think what they mean, and I just did a tour. I just did a tour called Kings of Clowns for a month in Germany. It was five clowns, and the headliner was Oleg Popov, who's 82 years old.
Right.
And he is the last of the legendary clowns. Emmett Kelly and Otto Griebling and all the Tati, Chaplin King, all the legendary clowns of this century. He's the last one. And what a treat, what a pleasure to tour with him. And he has the sweetest show. He was the, I don't know if you know the name, he was star of the Moscow Circus. And then he was the first one to come out when the wall came down.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wait, you mean he came out of the closet, or he came... No, no, just kidding.
So,
he popped off, I guess. No, I kid. Is he still funny?
A young performer.
Yeah.
It's all about success. You want to do everything better. And when you get to a certain age, you realize it's not really about success. It's how you deal with failure. And that's where the humor is.
Well, how do you deal with failure?
Well, I look for it. You know, I think the key to it is a kind of eternal optimism. That when you recognize a problem, instead of going, "Oh, you think, what could I do different? What, how did this happen?" You look at it, you go, interesting. And as long as you say, and this is for life as well, as long as you look at the problem and say, "Well, that's interesting. Oh, I know what to do." And then you try something. And in the theater, when we construct these routines, these numbers, you, when your tactic doesn't work, you don't feel a failure. You go, "Wow, that's even more interesting than I thought."
This is already in the context of the play itself, not if you're failing in front of an audience. Then you've got to... I've done that, believe me. I know what it is to fail in front of an audience, and that can be... That's not interesting. That's a lot worse than interesting.
I understand what you're saying, but if you think of the great performances, the relaxed... Oh, so that's what's happening. What we I do a lot of teaching now. We look at this clowning and problem solving as a kind of validation therapy for the audience.
So as they watch someone else fail and get back off their...
Yeah, we do it so they don't have to. It's almost, I never thought of it, it's almost Christian in its theology.
Like a bomb.
We fail for them.
Speaking of these things, your name is Avner Eisenberg. You got a long... I mean, you look like a real Hasid, almost Jew. How Jewish were you in your upbringing growing up? And what sect are you now? And would you like to join my shul?
Where's your shul?
Oh, we're in Great Neck, New York. It's Temple Sons of Bitches.
I went to a Hebrew day school. In fact, I was in the what's called the Hebrew Academy of Atlanta, which was one of the first Hebrew day schools in the country. And I graduated from there 52 years ago.
Mit Mazel.
And we just had our reunion. We had 14 kids in our class, and all but two came to the reunion.
That's wonderful.
And I hadn't seen, I'd only kept up with two of them, and only marginally. Oh, my God, you know what?
What?
These were my first friends, my oldest friends. We were together from first grade till seventh grade when we graduated.
That's right. I still have only one friend from my elementary school. And I hate him. But no,
exactly. So we had this reunion.
Yes.
And they just had the 60th anniversary of the school, so from when we started. And they asked me to come and do a fundraiser benefit show for the school. And they have we were in a little upstairs in the shul in like two little rooms when we first started the school. Now they have this beautiful, it's a campus.
Oh my God.
And they have a beautiful 800-seat theater. I'm so proud. They sold out the show. It was completely full. And a lot of my classmates came. It was funny, one of the eighth graders, the current eighth graders, made a few comments before the show.
Yes.
One of my classmates leaned over to me. I was backstage. He said, "You realize that when we graduated, that girl's parents weren't even born yet."
Oh, my. I hope you slugged him.
That's the joy of getting older.
It is. But, I mean, it's wonderful that you've kept in touch and that you've seen these people. By the way, we are talking with Avner Eisenberg, a.k.a. Avner, the eccentric, the performer, the actor, the mime, and also, as we've been hearing, the Jew. So are you non-observant? I mean, you're on the board of a synagogue now. How observant are you currently?
I'm not observant at all.
Oh.
I observe from the outside.
Do you feel like you're passing as a Jew then? Because you got the name and you got the beard, and people probably assume you're a lot more Jewy than you are.
You know, I was on the board of the synagogue. I actually left the board recently.
Oy.
Other people a chance. And my wife and I were both on the board, and our mission was to save the building. We had our son's bar mitzvah there. It was the first bar mitzvah in 15 or 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And to clean the sanctuary ourselves. It had gotten down to about 10 old men. I'm not exaggerating.
Well, a minion, at least you had that. Okay, yeah.
Went to make a minion. A friend of mine, I know in town. I live on an island off the coast of Portland.
Right.
I was in town one day, and I stopped into his office. He said, "Oi, Avner, I'm so glad you're here. Come on, we got to make a minion." I said, "Okay." Because, I had the training. So our mission was to preserve the building. And we were working to raise about $5,000 to fix a piece of siding that was coming off. And a whole other group, it's now a kind of schizophrenic shul, a group who came from the Reform shul, came onto the board. And at first I was a little offended by it. I think what I liked about the shul is it reminded me of going with my grandfather. I used to get up 6 in the morning whenever I was home in Atlanta, and I would go with him to shul. And one day we're sitting there 5:30 in the morning having coffee. He says, "I don't believe in God." I said, "What?" He said, "No, I don't." I said, "What are you doing? It's 5:30 in the morning." He said, "I like to see my friends. It makes me feel good." And I understood this, a lot when I was studying and when I used to be a camp counselor, that a lot of Judaism is the social contract.
Oh, absolutely. It's cultural, it's social, it's cultural, and it's free herring and cream sauce.
It made you get together in a group. You don't just say prayers. You have to see people. If you see people, you talk.
That's why they force the people once someone dies. You have to get out, you have to go to the Kaddish. It's not about saying the damn prayers. You're going to see.
You go be with people.
That's right.
These are wonderful ideas. These are concepts that are valuable. So anyway, this other group came in. We were knocking our heads on the wall. They raised $500,000.
Gewalt.
They completely renovated the building. And they made it into the Jewish Museum of Maine.
Oh, my God, that's
they
wonderful.
They rent it to the shul for $1 a year. So they have a Friday night, kind of like a Reform Reconstructionist service with a speaker, and they have music, and it's very community-oriented. And Saturday morning and Monday afternoon, they have the old men still get together and have their service. And you know what?
What?
It works. It really works. I have a great fondness for them. We just had the Purim party and the reading of the Megillah.
Did you go? You went?
Yeah, of course I went.
Oh, good. Well, so you're not quite non-observant, dude. You're going to the things. Do you have a Seder on Passover?
My sister and I do a Seder. Actually, it got so big we had to split into two groups out here on the island where we live. My sister also lives.
You keep mentioning this. Two things I have to ask about where you live. First of all, if you're from Atlanta, this is where you were born. Where's your accent? How come you don't sound like a cracker?
It wore off.
It did. Did you physically try to, because you were going to be an actor, force yourself to lose it, or you just moved from Atlanta and it naturally dissipated?
No, when I first got interested in theater, I became aware that I had a southern accent, and I worked hard to get rid of it. But I'm also a bit of a sponge for accents and languages. I lived in Minneapolis for about 8 years, and I came away with a kind of Midwestern accent that I had to work to get rid of. And now I sound like you. And we both sound like Jackie Mason.
Well, thank you, sir. Really, I thought I sounded more like Claude Rains. Damn it. I've been working so hard. So how the hell did you wind up on an island in Maine?
I had a friend who I met because we taught a workshop together, and her parents lived on this little island in Portland Harbor. And she told me about it. And I said, I can't believe they're Jewish people who live on islands in Maine. What do? Chop wood, feed the dog sled. So this was the Old People Express days. It was back when my show was just about to open on Broadway. And I flew up here for a weekend, and 2 weeks later I bought a little cottage. And it was the best move I ever made.
Well, isn't it wonderful to be able to, since you tour so much and you do so much in New York, that you get to just go to a little nice cottage all the way up in Maine, secluded with your family? I mean, I totally understand the beauty of that. Is that what it's all about?
Yeah, except it's a community. There are 800 or 1,000 people here. And it's the kind of place where you don't need turn signals on your car because everybody already knows where you're going.
Funny, but let me ask, though. If it's an island, A, isn't everything twice as expensive? Kind of like going to, Victoria from Vancouver or something like that. And also, what the hell else was I going to ask? Well, do you have to take a ferry to the thing or a boat, or can you drive?
No, there's a ferry. So if you could drive, it wouldn't be like an island.
Right, okay, this is...
Your neighborhood. It's not so expensive, and you don't have to lock your house. And that, you know what? That's worth a lot. My son, who's 24 years old now, he grew up hearing over and over again, if you get in trouble, talk to a stranger. They'll help you.
Because in your neighborhood.
We know all the island kids.
Yeah.
We know each other's families the way a neighborhood used to be. And there's an encompassing feeling in that you can't get anywhere else. Plus, this is the perfect island. It has a boat every hour.
Good.
When you get off, you're right in the middle of downtown Portland, which is a lovely city. It's a 10-minute cab ride to the airport. I can be in New York faster than my friends who live upstate.
That's good. Let me ask Avner Eisenberg, Avner the eccentric, how much time do you spend at home in Maine, and how much of the year or weeks do you spend touring and traveling and now doing the off-Broadway thing?
Well, probably 6 months. Here and 6 months away. It's a little hard to tell. I actually have to look it up in the computer and calculate it. Most of my work, because of the political climate and financial climate, things are tough in this country for the kind of medium-sized theaters that I play. I'd say about 80% of my work the last 10 years has been in Europe and in South America.
Wow. And do you travel alone or with your family, or what do you do?
I usually travel alone. I had a technician for about 15 years, and I simplified the show in a way that I didn't need to have the extra. It was nice having him, but I didn't need to. My wife travels with me occasionally, and...
But so let's say, let me think about this for a minute. Let's say you're going off to, as you said, you spent a month, you should pardon the expression, in Germany. Oy.
Yeah.
But so you go there, you need a table, a ladder, I mean, you can't be bringing all that stuff with you. Do you then go to a hardware store when you're in the country? What do you do?
Yeah, exactly. Depends where it is. In France and in Spain, I have a regular technician who I've been working with for years, and we have all that stuff.
So he keeps it in the garage, you go and get it?
No, I work with a producer who has a warehouse, and he represents other artists and has his own company. So Hector picks up the stuff. They rent a van when I'm going to go on tour. In fact, I'm going in November for a month-long tour in Spain.
Oh.
So Hector will pick up the stuff. He'll meet me at the airport, and off we'll go. I've been working with him for 5 or 6 years now. Other places, it's very simple. If you go to my tech ride, you'll see a menu item that says technical, and there's a list. And it's just a ladder, a carpet, a chair, and then some little stuff, a rose, some popcorn.
So, but again, it's a huge schlep, a little suitcase, all the other stuff is going to be...
I take two prop cases that are the size of a Foot Locker each, and they each weigh exactly 50 pounds.
Ooh.
So I can go as a regular passenger, and I work ahead with the theaters or the festivals. And so, they secure the ladder, the carpet, the stuff that I... But It's not hard stuff.
And the thing is, you've been doing it for so long that you have this whole thing down to a science, to the booking, to what you need, to getting there. I mean, that's what it's all about. And let me ask then, in coming up and doing what you do, the people that you learned with and that you studied with, one of your teachers was the legendary French mime, and again, you should pardon the expression, Jacques Lecoq.
Yes, okay.
I apologize to my listeners for having to say that, but I will say it again. But he, tremendously well-known mime, actually. What did he teach you?
I think, well, first of all, Lecoq is the first one to have put together a kind of comprehensive pedagogy for studying gestural theater. Pardon me for being serious.
Gewalt, yes.
There were two kind of poles in the silent theater world. One was De Croo, who was the teacher of Marceau, three really. Then there was Tomaszewski, who was the sort of Polish mime theater, which was based in ballet.
Well, this is not Boris Tomaszewski, the Yiddish actor. This is somebody else, right?
No. Okay. I don't know his first name.
Okay.
But De Croo's work and Marceau's work was based on an aesthetic decision. This is beautiful and this isn't. This is how you should move. This is how you shouldn't. And to use that analogy that what he was doing was like classical ballet, Lecoq was teaching jazz improvisation.
Oh, so you went more with or since you left, or after training with him, did you then start incorporating from both?
No, I worked really in the Lecoq style, and I've studied things on my own that I've gotten passionate about, and those have really gotten into my work. So one of the first things I studied was acrobatics and gymnastics. So that came into the work, and I was a juggler. Later, I studied magic, and it's still a great love of mine. So there's a lot of magic thinking in the show, and the dramatic sort of graph of magic is very different from the dramatic graph of theater.
In what way?
Well, in theater, you kind of build to a high point, and then for the last act, you tie up all the loose ends. In magic, you build to a high point, and to use the analogy of a card trick, you build to the high point, and you say, and your card was a three of clubs. There's nothing to say after that.
So you have to save the big one for the end, instead of... you don't have a denouement in magic, or what?
Well, it's the structure of humor, that the punchline happens, and you have to leave the audience alone to process it. You can't start explaining things to them at that point. So it makes for a different structure.
Right. Well, I mean, unless you look at Penn and Teller, where part of their thing was do it and then explain it and make fun of it.
I'm sorry, yeah. But their explanation is also a joke.
Well, yes, that to an extent. I mean, they will give away a secret, but not the whole secret.
Not really.
Right.
They will tell you they're giving away a secret.
But they're doing something else. Can I ask, since you are an expert mime and have studied and all this, what do you think of some of the more modern mime performers? Like right now, as we speak, preparing a show off Broadway are Bill Irwin and David Shiner again. Who did that?
David Shiner was one of the clowns on that Kings of Clowns tour in Germany. He lives in Germany.
Another Jewish boy in Germany? What the hell are they doing there? My God.
I don't think he's Jewish.
Really? Oh, that's a shame. I like him.
Yeah. We had a wonderful time. There was David Shiner, Peter Schaub, who is a Jewish guy from Philadelphia, who lives in Germany.
Right.
And René Bazinet, who's a French-Canadian, big star in Cirque du Soleil, and Oleg Popov, and myself. Oh, it was a funny moment.
What? Tell me.
Peter Schaub and I were being interviewed by a young... You know, Germany is really the hip place. It's the fastest-growing Jewish community in the world.
Well, because they were down to one, it's pretty easy to double. Yeah, all right.
Exactly. There's room. They have room to grow. And it's the place where klezmer music is making its big comeback. My wife is a klezmer musician, so I keep up with it. Anyhow, we were talking to a young guy in his sort of mid-20s, and he was marveling that there were two Jewish comedians in this show. He said, why do you think there aren't more Jewish comedians? And we looked at each other. Peter turned to him and said, do you think it might be because you tried to kill them all? And he went, what? Oh! And he was just horrified. His consciousness didn't include the Holocaust.
Well, because he's two generations already, you know, it's in his DNA, but it's not in his consciousness.
Right.
So, oh my, but that is, good for him for that comeback line. That's
yeah,
pretty
good. It was
good.
A wonderful moment.
Hey, I have to ask, are you familiar with...
Go ahead.
Because you still work on some level in a very traditional mime form. The things that you do with the balancing and the juggling and the papers and the tricks is still in a traditional way. Are you familiar with people like Billy the Mime, who are taking miming sort of another direction?
Yeah, I met him years ago, and we corresponded recently because he was going to Edinburgh, where I had played years ago, and we stayed in touch. He's very good. He's good because, you know, the original mime is really Marceau. And whatever you think about him, he invented an art form. And I saw him when I was in my late teens, and Marceau was a magician. You watched him and you went, I don't know how he does that. And it was just like watching Penn and Teller or David Copperfield. You went, I don't know what he's doing. And later, when it was decoded and you understood what he was doing, it was then the equivalent of watching a birthday party magician because you knew how everything worked.
Oh.
Still, he invented the art form. Billy is he's not so brilliant technically as a mime, but the subjects and the connections he makes, mime is just the form he uses to really tell outrageous stories.
That's just so you appreciate that, even though you don't do that necessarily yourself, you can appreciate.
Oh, exactly. You know, there's almost nothing in my show that couldn't have been done by a caveman around the fire. A lot of this stuff is very avant-garde, and I think I'm very firmly entrenched as derrière-garde.
Is that really a French phrase, derrière guard, rear guard? Is that what it really is?
I made it up. Avant-garde means ahead of. I'm behind the curve.
Well, because, hey, look, you've got people who love you, come to see you all over the world. You get to do what you love to do. It doesn't get better than that, dude. It really doesn't, you know?
Yeah, it's what a life.
Although I will say we didn't really mention the fact that when you were coming up and doing the Broadway show in that heyday in the mid-1980s, you had this featured role in Jewel of the Nile. Was that character already there, or did they sort of write it around your skills?
Well, it's funny. When I read the first script, it was very clearly kind of Alec Guinness in Jewel in the Crown, or it was a portly, kind of sardonic English character. And so I got a call from my agent at the time that Michael Douglas wanted to meet me. And I actually had another obligation and asked my agent if he would go. I sort of thought they might be offering me a part as an auxiliary juggler because my friends at Flying Caramazzo Brothers were already...
Oh, yes.
...cast. Anyhow, things escalated. Turned out to be dinner with Michael Douglas and Louis Teague, the director. And we chatted for a while. And they said, so I understand you've read the script. I said, yeah. And they said, so do you want to do the part? And I said, well, which part exactly? And they looked at each other, surprised that it wasn't clear, and said, well, the jewel. And I tried to talk them out of it.
Why?
Well, I found that that's a good way to get parts. I pointed out that I didn't, you know, I still had this image of this English guy. I said, well, you know, I don't really speak. They had seen my show. You know, it's really a blessing. They saw something in me that I never would have put forward and said, well, I can do that part. It really changed my life, not just the fact of having done it, but also the confidence to approach other acting roles.
But that does surprise me.
I had to go to a dialect coach.
Yes.
To learn how to do an Arabic accent. I went to Michael, I was jokingly, I said, Michael, my rabbi is going to be upset when he hears I'm playing a religious Arab. He said, your rabbi, how do you think the Arabs are going to feel?
He's a nice Jewish boy too, you know.
He is.
So is his dad. But the one thing that I'm a little surprised at is that you got such wonderful rave reviews for that movie and for playing that role that it didn't compound into more of a featured movie career. Was that because you had to do, you were also doing so much theater at the time, or just didn't get that next role that...
I don't know. I actually never had an agent before the movie. And I got an agent, and they were, when I called some casting directors that I knew and said, you know, I really need to get an agent, they were so surprised that I didn't have one.
Right,
so I had an agent, and I used to go for auditions. I did one other feature film called Brenda Starr, but it was so bad, I think it opened on an airplane.
Was that the Brooke Shields movie?
Yeah.
Right, I never saw it, no offense, but...
Nobody saw it.
Okay, yes.
And I used to go to L.A. and hang out. I went every year for pilot season. I was up for a lot of great parts. But I don't know why it didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
Can I ask, were there any... I'm always fascinated by this. Any parts that you auditioned for or read for that, you know, what were they? And who got them?
I don't even remember. One I remember was a TV series. There was a character, you only see his eyes behind a fence. Something about a handyman.
Oh my God, the tool tie. Oh, well, okay, that one, yes. The Home Improvement.
That's right.
Yeah, well.
I auditioned for that and for the his sidekick, the guy who actually knows how to do things. And I got shortlisted for a lot of them. Something I think the public doesn't really understand is that movies get, for the most part, are packaged. So the agency that has the star also gets to put all their own people in the movie.
Oh, that's right.
And the rest of it, they never have their funding till the last minute. They're not sitting there with $22 million in the bank. So they wait till they have the funding. They put out a casting call on Tuesday. And you go in Tuesday and Wednesday, the thing starts shooting on Friday.
Wow.
I did a Woody Allen movie. I played Woody Allen's brother-in-law.
In what movie? What movie?
In Crimes and Misdemeanors, but the movie was too long, and that whole section that included my character didn't make the final cut.
Was that your biggest disappointment, maybe, of doing what you of your career?
That was disappointing. It was very interesting. I shot it for a week. I flew home from New York on Friday. I get a call Sunday afternoon. What are you doing tomorrow? I said, I don't know. What did you have in mind? Well, we need to reshoot some of your scenes. Mm. So I immediately, the paranoid in me, thought, oh, God, I screwed it up. His brother-in-law dies, and then they show his life in flashbacks. So the first morning I showed up, it's freezing. We're out on the steps of City College, supposed to be Columbia University, in 1968, a big anti-war rally. And I hadn't really met Woody Allen. I came in for the casting, and they took me through these hallways to a dark room, and there was a little bitty guy sitting in a really big armchair, and he looked just like Woody Allen. And he stood up, he looked at me, he said, thanks for coming in. Did we get a Polaroid of him?
Oh, no.
Juliet thought you'd be right for this part. Thanks for coming in. And he turned around and walked away. I thought, oh, God, that was a waste of time. So I went shopping. And finally, I got to the airport. I called my agent. I said, I just wanted to say. They said, where have you been? We've been trying to get a hold of you. This was before cell phones. You had to go find a
place. Right, yes.
They said, where have you been? You got the part.
Oh, my God. And yet, of course.
So I went down.
Yeah.
I got the thing. So the first thing is I'm making an anti-war speech. And there are about 1,000 people watching, just pedestrians who are watching the scene, which was great for me because I just pretended they were the anti-war crowd.
Right, of course.
And there are all these New York actors. And I had this feeling they're going, who is this guy? What's he doing here? I've never seen him before. So I got up and I did my speech. And Woody comes walking over to me. He says, well, we're having a little trouble with the camera move. So I need you to just stretch it we need it to be about twice as long.
Okay.
Oh, jeez. Woody Allen wants me to improvise a scene in his movie. And I have no idea what to say. So I did. I improvise the scene, and I use rhetorical devices.
Like?
You know, I repeated myself.
Oh, okay, right. They were cutting out in the movie anyway.
Scene, I'm in bed with tubes up my nose.
Oi.
Woody Allen is sitting there beside me, and we're chatting, and I had a great line. I said to him, you know, I feel more alive now that I'm actually dying than when I was alive.
Did he write that line, or did you make that one up?
Trying to kill myself.
Right.
No, that was his line.
It was okay, yeah.
So I get there, and I go into makeup, and they start slathering a makeup color called Frankenstein Gray.
Right.
And they're putting green lines inside my eyelids. And Woody comes into makeup. He says, you know why we were reshooting this? I said, no. He said, we got to look at the dailies from the hospital scene when you're dying. I said, yeah. Still expecting him to say, and you fuck up your lines. He said, we showed it to some people, and you look healthier than I did.
Oh, my God. Well, he always did look like a sickly kid. That's funny.
So we reshot that scene, and they actually, to tell you how far they go, the production designer got in touch with me. They had to show the apartment that I had been living in with his sister. They got baby pictures and teenage pictures and high school pictures and used them to put around the apartment.
My God.
Yeah.
So, but none of this made the movie?
None of it's in the movie.
Oh, you're not even in a moment, a second?
No, the whole character, the whole story was left out.
Now, I'm wondering, did you ever ask, I wonder if this can happen, if the actor can at least ask for the footage. Is it somewhere?
I don't know. You know, that's a thought.
I'd be fascinated by that. Now every DVD comes with a million outtakes.
We don't have to get in touch with Woody's producer and ask.
Yeah, Leggy, what's her name? Is it...
Taylor's his casting director. Jack Rollins is his producer.
Right, so maybe, you know. And if they ever do a 25th whatever anniversary of Crimes and Misdemeanors, maybe they'll put those scenes on outtake
nice.
Things.
That would be nice.
I would love to see that. Oh my God. We are talking about Woody Allen and Jewishness and mime and comedy with Avner the Eccentric, a.k.a. Avner Eisenberg. And I have been remiss, by the way, in not being more specific and letting you know that Exceptions to Gravity is going to be playing at the Canal Park Playhouse on Canal Street between Greenwich and West Streets in Tribeca in New York. It's starting performances, or started performances, I should say, on March 1st for a limited run only through March 25th. So you have about 3-4 weeks to see Avner doing Exceptions to Gravity. But let me get back a little bit to the character that you play, who is of course in some ways Chaplin-esque, but also it's kind of Moshe Rosenblatt-esque, where you on your website you even mention this list of things that eccentric principles.
Yeah.
What is all that?
Well, this came up because I teach a lot. I've been teaching 25 years. And it's a very different pedagogy from most acting training. The biggest difference is that most theater training doesn't take into account anything about what the audience is feeling. In fact, I just got a big book that a friend put together, and that doesn't mention the audience once. Now, and I think they're 51% of any show.
Wow, okay.
So a couple of big breakthroughs for me mentally. One was watching students for years doing things that should be funny, and they weren't funny. And I thought, why? What's going on? What's wrong? And I realized one day that the emotion that they were communicating was fear. So I started asking them, what are you afraid of? What's your emotional state before you go on stage? And they always say some version of, geez, I hope it doesn't suck.
Well, yeah, right.
There's a fear of what we used to call fear of failure, but that's not good enough because we want to fail so we can triumph. It's like that guy said on the Academy Awards, it doesn't matter if you get knocked down. It's how you get up that counts.
Right. Well, Jennifer Lawrence took that tumble. That's right.
Yeah. If you don't get knocked down, it's not interesting.
So
then I started asking students, well, how do you feel when you go to watch a show? And you probably get this every time you do an interview? I hope it doesn't suck.
Right, and Spielkiss and all that sort of thing, and I hope I don't start coughing.
Good. I went to see a friend's show the other day, and I know they're good, but I was sitting there going, oh, God, I hope this is good. I've been to so many shows that aren't. So that led to the first... So you've got audience and performer. They're terrified of each other.
Huh.
So then we find ways to dissipate that terror and create rapport. So the first principle is the body tells the story. Their body was telling the story that they were afraid, even though their mouth and their gestures were telling whatever the story they were trying to tell. But the fear overshadowed all of that. So that actually led me to my latest study. I'd become a certified hypnotherapist.
So you believe in hypnosis, you think it works and it can help people and you can put people in sort of a trance state?
Well, belief is a funny thing. I mean, you're back to religion now. No, there's actual evidence. It works.
Good. Okay.
It helps people. And I went to study it because I had some time off. I had shoulder surgeries. I had a few months off. I took a course because I thought somewhere I might be able to help students with stage fright. Because so many of them have.
Oh, yes.
Some level of stage fright, of anticipatory anxiety. And oh, boy, does it work. It works like a charm.
But when you go out on stage, I assume you're keyed up, you're excited, whatever, but you have no fear whatsoever. You know you're going to go out there and feel love.
No, you don't know what's going to happen. It's like meeting someone. You trust your skills to forge a harmonious, sympathetic relationship with them. Let me give you an example.
Please.
Because the question is laughter. You got to get laughs. If you're a comedian, you have to get laughs.
Right.
But if you try, you can't get them.
So
what do you do? So I was in a show, in a variety show. There were two comedy acts. And this was the night that nobody laughed.
Oh, boy.
It was really, really quiet out there. And I had dinner with the other comedian who was very upset. He was screaming. I mean, he was really upset about it. He said, Andre, what do you do? What do you do when you don't get laughs? And then I had a real breakthrough, and this was another principle. I said, thank God, I've got enough problems out there without people laughing at me. See, the problem isn't the laughs. The problem is asking for them.
Right, let them...
You're like a kid. You say, Mommy, can I have some ice cream? No, you can't. Now what are you going to do? One of my favorite phone calls was from my sister. I was talking to her. Her 5-year-old son, 4 years old, said, Mommy, can I have some ice cream? She said, no, you can't have ice cream until after dinner. And he said, but I said, please.
Right. And please doesn't always cut it. You can't beg an audience for laughs.
Right. So you can't, the rule is you can't go looking for laughs. And this goes back to the validation therapy. Someone laughs at you, it interrupts you. You've got to deal with it.
So
they're saying, that's funny. And you look at them and you say, I know. But let me get on with my job. But what happens if they don't laugh?
Right.
You look at them, and your look says, this isn't funny, I know.
And that makes them laugh, or it just puts them in your corner?
It makes them laugh.
Hmm.
It lets them be at ease.
Interesting.
A guy stands up and yells, you suck! You're terrible! You can't juggle! You look at me and go, I know.
Has anybody ever done that to you?
Yeah, actually, it did happen.
You were heckled? When the hell were you heckled?
It was on Broadway.
No.
Yeah.
Was it a friend just trying to take...
No, it was a drunk guy.
Oh, my... So you just looked at him and...
I looked at him and went, I know. I just shrugged and went, yeah, I know. And everybody else booed him and they kicked him out.
Well, yeah, of course, but oh, my... That's... Such fascinating stuff, because, you know, I have done a show that I'm working on and still doing of my own, and there are times when the audience loves it, and there are times when they don't love it so much. But
Let
I have
tell
to...
you something.
What?
You realize that people don't laugh when they're alone.
Mm-hmm.
When you're home alone, you can watch the funniest movie, you won't laugh out loud.
Not much, no, that's true.
But you put another person in the room, and it's hilarious. A very good friend of mine brought his sister to the show. And he had seen the show half a dozen times, and I know he likes it a lot. His sister Mr. Love, she was crying. She was laughing so hard. He sat there like one of those characters from American Gothic. He looked like that old dried up guy. He didn't laugh once. He sat there with his hand on his chin and just watched the show. Later, so that was in January. In July, he and I went on a little sailing trip, and we're sitting out in the boat one day. He says, you know, I meant to tell you, my sister still tells me, every time I talk to her, how much she loved the show. He said, and you know, I've seen it half a dozen times. I don't think I've ever laughed that hard before. And that really, then this goes back to that idea about understanding the audience, not just looking at what the actor does. He was in his mind. That's where you laugh, inside your mind.
Well, there's an appreciation there. It's like sometimes this is a traditional theater thing. They might do a show on a Tuesday night, their first night back after the weekend. And you're doing a comedy and the audience is just like, they're there, they're watching. It's like statues in the audience. And yet they get to the end of it and the applause is like, yay, 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 we loved it, we loved it. And the actors had no idea.
They don't know they're not laughing. He didn't know he wasn't laughing out loud.
Wow.
So don't ever be mad at the audience.
Oh, well, you can sometimes be a little mad at the audience.
Only if they heckle you.
This is true. We are speaking
with...
What are
you doing?
I do, before we have to let you go, this has just been so wonderful talking to Avner Eisenberg. Avner, the eccentric, I should say. And also, Avner, the brilliant and wonderful, because you really have been. But I did notice on your resume that, I mean, okay, I understand... You would get the Middle Eastern part in Jewel of the Nile, and I get that you're doing, you know, this character in Avner the Eccentric, but how on earth did you wind up, maybe because you look like the Mr. Natural a little bit, but you played R. Crumb? That seems very far afield. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, I look like him.
No, you... You look like Mr. Natural. You don't look like R. Crumb.
I look like him now, but I look like him when I shave. In fact, we have a picture of me and Robert side by side, and him dressed the way he dresses, me in a costume. And you almost can't tell them apart.
Really? I'm trying to picture, because I saw the documentary movie, Crumb, a few years ago.
Yeah.
But what did you played him in a bio-docu-theater show? What was that?
Yeah. The guy who first got me interested in theater got in touch. I forget how we got. I did a show in Dallas, and he has a little theater in Fort Worth. He came over. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. And he called me. He said, we're doing this R. Crumb thing. And Robert had been involved with the Delarte Players. I never met him when he was there, but I was one of the first teachers at Delarte when it first opened.
Okay.
So I knew a little about his work, and you know, it was funny. My first, I asked him, "Guys, he's still alive?" He said, "Yeah." A lot of people ask that. He's just a couple of years older than me. He actually came. I flew down to Texas, and they had a local production. I had a look at the show and read the script. I said, "Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun to do." And Robert came and stayed for a week and actually painted the set. So I got to hang out with him, and we became very good friends. And I've visited him in France a couple of times now.
Oh, that's wonderful. I had no idea that you had gotten... Does he live a completely normal life now, except for, you know, what's going on? Now that his family's gone, you know, all the crazy brother and the mother and all that.
Yeah, I mean, when I first met him, I went to visit him in Irvine, California.
Irvine, yeah.
Living in. The Johnny Simons, the director, set it up. And boy, you walk into his house, and it's a kind of place you expect the teacups and saucers to get up and start dancing.
Wow.
Very beautiful kind of retro kind of look and things that he chooses to have around him. Yeah, his wife is Jewish, you know, Aileen Kaminsky.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, he's probably the most honest person I've ever met.
Interesting.
He doesn't compromise at all his feelings, and he has very strong feelings about music. He doesn't really listen to anything that was recorded after about 1920.
Well, he had the cheap suit Sarah Eggers. He was actually in a band.
All that old string band music.
Right.
And he's a serious record collector.
Oh, cool.
Boy, can he draw.
Well, yes.
And he can't stop. He does it all the time. I was hoping he'd let me watch him just in doing my homework for the character. He never stops.
Well, I guess...
And I think his life is very settled, and, you know, he's this kind of superstar, but he's very quiet. He has his cafe and his walks and his...
He has the life that he wants, the way that you have developed the perfect life for what you want to do. And, I mean, that's what it's, as I said before, that is what it's all about. And for this past hour, it has been all about the wonderful Avner Eisenberg, Avner the Eccentric. I mean, before I let you go, I want to do two things. Again, I want to remind people that they can see Exceptions to Gravity at the Canal Park Playhouse on Canal Street between Greenwich and West Street in New York. It's running through Sunday, March 25th. Do I have a telephone number here? Yes, you can get tickets at Ovation Tix, 866-811-4111. That's 866-811-4111. And again, my last question before I let the terrific Avner Eisenberg go is, and it's, I guess it's kind of a loaded question, but why do people think, I'm not saying that they do, but why do people think they hate mimes?
Well, they've been burned before, haven't they?
That's as good an answer as any. But no, I mean, they really probably haven't seen that many mimes except either Marcel Marceau on TV, or they see them outside the, you know, the library building.
No, there's
spray paint.
A kind of a myth in professional magic that people don't like card tricks. But the truth is, most people have never seen a real card trick. They've seen Uncle Louie do that trick where you deal 11 cards and you tell them what row they're in. Most people have never seen a card trick.
Okay.
There's a guy named Michael Weber had a wonderful thing he said. He said, make them love you, then you can do anything, even card tricks. I think mime is the same. Mime is an art form. It's like not liking oil paintings. Well, there might be paintings you don't like, but you can't not like the paint.
I think that's a wonderful way of putting it.
Mime is an art form. You can use it for good or evil. The choice is yours.
Wow. Well, we've certainly seen Avner Eisenberg do his mime for good. And you can go see him on stage. You can also go to his website. Is it AvnerTheEccentric.com? Is that the...
That's it, exactly.
Avner, A-V-N-E-R. AvnerTheEccentric.com. But please, go see him while you have the chance. If you go look at a clip or two of his on YouTube, you will want to rush to the box office at Canal Street Playhouse to go see him in person and watch him deal with gravity and mime and comedy and letting the audience do what it wants because he knows what he's out there to do. Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Eccentric, I should say. It has been absolutely a joy to have you in the neighborhood.
It was a pleasure chatting with you, Rabbi. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and shalom to you.
Shalom, Mitzvot.